I make a deal, all right? And they, kind of the way it went, you know. I did the same thing with this big eight-wheel rubber tire Bobcat out of Longmont, Colorado. By that time, I had gained a little credibility, all right, you know. And so I put all this deal together with planes. And then I put two of those big D-Mags in Texas, one here at Morton Lake and one at Rockdale. The one at Rockdale, we took the diesel engine out and put an electric motor, hydraulic from then on, all right. We got them to do it to the factory. The one up here, both of them were the first hydraulic excavator backhoes, all of them in Germany were front shovels. You know what I mean? The other thing I did, when I got the order from up here at Martin Lake from David Reedy, he wanted a Cummins engine. Now, this is like a V16, you know, 1,350 brake horsepower. And I called my friend in Chicago that was with D-Mag, and I said, can we do it? He said, yeah, we can do it. They hadn't put a Cummins in one of them yet. They were all Detroits. So I took the order. Well, when I turned the order in, and the little German in George Meyer in Chicago, he said to Dusseldorf, Germany, they kicked it back on us. Yeah, we didn't want to do that. And he called me, the little German did, and he spoke good English, and he was articulate. He said, Steve, they don't want to do it. They don't think that Cummins can support that engine, that it's a new engine, and they don't think they got the parts, blah, 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 blah. I said, George, I'm not going down there until David Reedy at Texas Utility said that he's got to have a Detroit. He said, what's that? He'll cancel the order. He hates the Detroits. He had Detroits in that core, and he hated them. He likes Cummins because all them Cummins trucks got Cummins engine in them, and he likes the service. He said, George says, what are we going to do? I said, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to Germany. You're going to get the Fuhrer and his staff in a room, and I'm going to turn them around. He said, good deal. So sure enough. Now, I had never been across the pond at this time, all right? So before I leave, I go to the Cummins sales people in Dallas and Arlington. They cover five states, all right? And I don't have to explain to them how big TU is because they're supplying TU them trucks, them engines. I go in there and I said, look, you guys are getting ready to cost me a $2 million deal. They said, why? I said, the Germans, I've just sold an excavator to Texas Utilities with a KTA 3067 Cummins, and the people in Germany tell me you can't support it. Oh, no, 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 no. We got them in the oil field, blah, 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 blah. I said, I'm going to Germany, turn them around. I said, I need your help. They said, what do you want, Mr. Cole? I said, I want a letter from a vice president, or at least a vice president, stating that you will stock a brand new KTA 3067 diesel engine in the Arlington branch and put Texas Utilities name on it. I don't care if Halliburton comes in here or Brown and Root or whoever wants it. They ain't getting it. That's going to be over in the corner for Texas Utilities. They said, you got a deal, son. I got that letter. And the next thing I did, I had these charts. One of my charts had the state of Texas. This chart's 36 by 36 and got the state, a map. And that scene comes in around Texarkana and it goes out around, I think, Del Rio, somewhere down the
lower part. The coal scene?
Yeah, scene, yeah. And so just... That whatever that map scale was, I went and had a guy make me a clear plastic overlay and draw in the country of Germany to scale, all right? And when you lay Germany over Texas, it covers about one-third. It covers about the territory that I was covering, you know. Here I go with this, the Germany. I got my charts and my projector again, the whole nine yards, all right? We get over there, and everybody over there is PhD. You know, they're beautiful people, and they're smart, but you got to convince them. And they got their heels dug in. So I show them the slides. Then I show them the chart. And now, you got to realize, this is 79. PhD, and there's no reflection on him, because if you ask me where Dusseldorf is, I can't tell you today, and I've been here three times. He says, is Denver in Texas, you know?
It was before 1850.
When I laid that map over that Texas and they saw that my territory was as big as their country, it dawned on them, maybe this account is this big, you know? Maybe we ought to bend the rules and, I want you to know what they said. When I got through talking to him, I said, can we keep your slides in charge to show the board? I said, yeah. So I came home and left all that over. I knew then that we had won the argument, sure enough. So I sold the first machine in the world with a Cummins engine in it. I sold the first D-Mag with backhoe attachment. And I sold the first D-Mag with electric motor wrench in 1979.
And I want you to tell about the big one that you made, the 95-yard cubic yard one. But before we do that, though, tell me a little bit about where you think you got your negotiating skills from.
Number one, I grew up on that rice farm, which is you're always swimming up river. Working in the mud is 10 times harder than working on dry land, all right? It teaches you to be a problem solver. Number one, all right? So I got my mechanical aptitude and problem-solving skills working in under those harsh conditions, all right? And then my daddy was way ahead of the curve, you know, and I studied at his feet, okay, you know, so I got that. But
a lot of your success was dealing with people, though.
Okay, at 25 years old, while I was on the farm, I was having trouble communicate with my banker. And I thought I needed some communicating skills. At the time, I didn't realize that I was talking so fast. He didn't catch it, okay? And he would ask me to repeat it, and I thought he was doubting what I was telling him, you know, because he was an Aggie graduate, and I thought so much of him, and I didn't have any idea that he was asking me this so he could understand what the hell I was telling him. So it aggravated me when he'd do that. So I read about this Dale Carnegie course, so I thought I was going to take a speech course. I thought that's what it was. You get up and learn. I got in there and realized it's a human relations course. I don't know if you've ever been to a Dale Carnegie course, but it's on how to deal with people. It's speech is a small part of it. It's on how to, you know, if some old company or some major company has a problem employee, before they'll fire him, if they think he's got some potential, they'll send him a Dale Carnegie course and try and straighten him up, all right? All right, the next thing was, my brother, when we left the farm, I go in the restaurant, he goes to Houston. He'd been selling Kirby vacuum cleaners down there while he was in college for a while, you know? But he goes to this, I think it was called Holiday Magic. It's a cosmetic company, all right? And they have this professional sales training program they send you through, right? And they had this instructor, and they had this Duquesne projector. It was with the slides, and it was a real. They had bought it from a professional sales training company called Larry Wilson, that came out of the insurance business. So my brother's taking this course, and the instructor's an ex high school teacher out of San Antonio, named Jim Taylor. And about the time my brother graduates, the FTC comes down on Holiday Magic and tells them, you can't do what you're doing because you're a pyramid scheme. So they're out of business. So my brother and this Jim Taylor, they hit the road together, the instructor and the student. They go in business together, selling fire extinguishers for the next 2 or 3 years. And this Jim Taylor has this Larry Wilson Sales Sonics course, all right? The record, the slides, the book, worth its weight in gold, right? And my brother tells me about it, you know, while I'm in a catfish business. So anyhow, they 2 or 3 years go by, and they decide they're going to go their separate ways. You know, the fire extinguisher business is more than they bargained for. And so when they're splitting the blanket up, this Jim Taylor owes my brother $500. And Jim said, I ain't got the $500, but I've got this Larry Wilson Sales Sonics course. Won't you take that in payment? Well, my brother said, yeah. So he took that and puts it in his closet. So later on, when I had to tell my brother I want to go into sales, you know, and leave the restaurant business, and I tell him, I said, I want that Sales Sonics course. So it's been sitting in his closet. So I go to boning up on that thing. I want to tell you, that thing was worth its weight in gold. It shortened my learning curve. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And does that answer your question?
Yes, yes,
and,
yes.
So where were we at now?
You were going to talk about the big 95 cubic yard.
Well, no. What we're going to jump to is that big track machine, the big drag line. I had nothing to do with that other than interface with it. You know,
okay.
I sold wire rope at one time after I went business myself. I was a rep selling wire rope. But, okay, where did I just finish up at?
You got the D-Mag.
We got the D-Mag, okay. All right, here's what, so I'm at Planning's, and one other thing the customer had on his list, remember I told you he had this wish list? They were using, say a drag line can dig maybe 100 feet deep, that's it. He runs out of, it's like a man digging a grave with a shovel, and you get so deep you can't get the dirt out.
Right.
Well, a drag line gets that way. He can only get so far. But let's say you got 150 foot to go, all right? Well, you got to come up with another system we call it pre-benching. You take that first 50 feet off out of the drag line's way where he doesn't see it. And then he can deal with the rest, all right? Now, you can do that with a truck shovel. You can do it with scrapers. Well, they were doing it with scrapers. The twin engine, you know what a scraper is, twin engine cat scraper? They'd scrape it over here on this side, come down across that pit, 100 feet deep, come up to the other side, and go over here and deposit the dirt, and then come back around on another bridge across the pit. 30 of these things running round the clock. Well, if you got 30 scrapers running around the clock, you're going to have 10 of them that are in the shop. I mean, they're high maintenance, all right? And you're going to have a traffic cop out there at night to keep from running over one another, right? It's going to cost you $1.50 a yard to do it, all right? Push come to shove. So you're moving 20 million yards of dirt, you know? It's cost you $30 million, all right? Something like that. So anyhow, they had been talking to them. Now, in Germany, they have what they call the in-round system. They'll put a bucket wheel over here, cut in the virgin material, and put it on a belt and bring it down to the end of the pit, say 5,000 feet, come across the end of the pit 1,000 feet, come back up this other side another 5,000, and then put it on a stacker and stack it over here. So you got, you know, 10, 15,000 foot of belt and 3 or 4 pieces in tandem, and it moves, shifts like a shiftable railroad, right? It's a nightmare. That was one way. Texas Utility wasn't a part of that. They had been talking about in mining schools for 30 years about sitting on the virgin side, you know, the hard side, and reaching across the pit and putting the dirt on the second small pile beyond the drag line without interfering with the drag line, right? Well, Texas Utilities had tried to talk. Now, you got to realize Texas Utilities had bought probably $100 million worth of Marion drag lines and shovels, $100 million worth of Bucyrus Erie drag lines and shovels at that time. Bucyrus Erie. And they had tried to talk them into engineering, something like that. And both of them had their hand out. Said, you give us some money up front to engineer and we'll do it. Well, it offended Texas Utilities, you know, because they thought that they ought to be more willing to work with them. Well, I'm in there listening to all this, you know. So What Texas Utilities wanted was a long reach, lightweight, high volume, low price machine, which all the PhD says that's impossible, all right? To have all those in one thing. Well, I've been there one day waiting to see Cliff Irwin, who's my mentor, on the 17th floor. I'm sitting there at the coffee table like this. On the coffee table is a magazine. It's a transportation magazine, and it's featured on the front of it is a homemade crane that's used in nuclear power plants, which means it's got a tremendous lifting capacity, yet it's got a quick erection and knockdown capabilities in hauling to the next job. Made by an outfit out of Washington State. They're still in business. So anyhow, that boom on it was like 400 feet long, and it was a lightweight machine. I could visualize laying that boom down to about 10 degrees and putting a belt on it. Well, sitting next to me was a fellow who was paid to follow me around. He was a vice president of the company on the board, named Joe Terrell. He retired from Gilvin and Terrell out in West Texas. They built all interstates out in West Texas. He was a millionaire, civil engineer from the University of Texas, and he was a friend of the Pioneer Gas people in the Preston Plains. And when they hired me, Morris Bailey was smart enough to hire Joe as a consultant. Said, I want you to go out there and check on this old boy 2 days a week. Fly down to Dallas and ride with him. Thank God they did that, because he kept the politics off my back, huh? And I showed this to Joe. I said, Joe, this is it. We could tackle, do that, blah, blah, blah. Well, Joe didn't understand. And Joe believed in me, all right? He couldn't see what I was seeing, all right? I took the magazine into Cliff when I got to see him, my mentor, who was waiting to see there. And I'm trying to explain to him. He can't see it. I said, Cliff, can I have the magazine? He said, yeah. So I take it home. I'm living in Houston at the time. I go back to Houston. Well, we had hired this prince of a guy, PhD, Frank Kay. And he had the engineering division in Houston. He and I are the same age. We're buddies. I go in to see Frank. I said, Frank, I need you to make some isometric drawing. I was trying to explain to him what to do. I said, no, this thing will work, blah, 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 blah. He listened to me about 10 minutes. He said, Cole ain't got time for your blue sky deals. He said, put her in a basket and we'll get to it. Well, you know what that means, all right? So I still got the magazine today. All this is on the Facebook page. You can see all this. So I go home. I'm in the field now. We're putting together this, I think, DMAG over here. Martin Lake, so I'm communicating back. I'll spend a whole week up here in the field, you know. It's July, and I'm in that Mercury. I got the windows rolled up, air conditioning running, the mechanics right there working, and I'm on a little sketch pad, you know, working all this stuff out in two dimensions. And they want to ask me something about the machine. They go and knock on the window, and I roll the window down, and I'll answer their question. So after about 30, now I'm calling my buddy Cliff in Dallas and ask him questions. And after about 30 days, I got it all worked out. And I got a meeting with him. This is for the Monday following July the 4th weekend. So I'm going home that weekend. And I'm planning on going fishing, saltwater fishing. And the further I get, the closer I get to home, I get to think, you know, I go in there and I had all this stuff in about 20 pages. You know, two-dimensional. I said, if I go in there with all this, I'm going to lose them. I go home, and I spend a whole 2 or 3 days on a drawing board. I had been on a drawing board 20 years. Now, I went to A&M. I took mechanical drawing. In high school, I took mechanical drawing. Right? I make it isometric. You know what that is, 3D. Crude. But it's to scale. And I lay it all out there, you know. And I got an appointment with him at 9 a.m. in the morning in Dallas. I'm living in Houston. I get through on this thing about 1 o'clock in the morning. I'm going to lay down, sleep till 3, get up, shave, and hit the road. Well, I lay down at 1, I can't go to sleep. I'm just wide awake, you know. So, sure enough, I hit the road. I'm at the air 9, and Cliff's there with his boss and two other engineers, and I lay this thing out on the table and I go explain it to them. And they're, And they said, we want you to take and show this to Abo. Now, Abo was, at that time, he was at Mount Pleasant. He was the guy they would send in to straighten the mine up if, it was, if things was going wrong, you know. This guy rose to be vice president at Texas Utilities and the only one that didn't have a college degree. Started out as a dozer operator at Rockdale 30 years previous, all right?
For the Alcoa company.
Huh? Yeah. It was Texas Power and Light supplying coal to the Alcoa plant, okay. Power company. You see what I'm saying? That's where they started. Texas Power and Light was a forerunner, along with Texas Electric Service and Dallas Power and Light. They all became Texas Utilities. That's how it came to be, yard. But it all started down there at Rockdale.
With the aluminum company.
And by the way, the other day when I was talking to you, I said that the aluminum company was looking for someone to build a power plant to provide lignite. It's the other way around. TP&L had the reserves, and they were looking for an aluminum company that they could sell the reserve to make electricity for, okay? And all that. And I went into Texas Utilities. They wrote a little book on the history of the company, which is in here for you, okay? So anyhow, I got sidetracked there.
But you had shown your isometric drawing.
Yeah, I showed them the isometric drawing. Said, we want you to go show this to Abo. Well, if you got 20 minutes of Abo's time, previous to that, you were doing good, all right? Well, I went in there, got there 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning, Mount Pleasant. And he kept me for 2 hours, asking me questions, you know. He said, go back and shrink that drawing down. You know, take this out, do this. So I went home and I come back in about a week and he looks at it again. He said, do some more. So I go back and come back another week and he said, that's what I like. So now we're going to go back to Dallas with the drawing. So you show it to Mr. R.J. Gary, who was executive vice president over the mining.
R.J. Gary,
principal guy. So here we go. Now, you got to realize, at this time, I've gone underground. I ain't told planes and nobody. The reason I didn't, because I knew if I went home after Frank K., the PhD, turned me down and called Morris Bailey, you know, and whined on it and said he won't, he would have called Frank, and Frank would have said Cole's gone off the reservation and they would have told me to quit working on it or whatever. So I didn't say zilch to nobody, Joe Terrell, Frank K., anybody. I'm underground. So when I go in to CTU, Mr. Gary, planes don't know I'm doing anything, all right? And I don't have planes' name nowhere on that paper. I didn't use their drawing paper. I just used some plain drawing paper. That way I could, if they threw me out the building and said, who's this crazy guy, it wouldn't reflect on planes. They could say, well, hell, we didn't tell him to go up there. He's going off the reservation, you know. And so they want me to go in to see Mr. Gary with all this. So I'm laying it all out there. And he says, Mr. Cole says, we'd like to talk to the Germans. Because, see, the Germans not only made hydraulic excavators, which we were the dealer for, their sister company made these big belt systems. And they had the ability to engineer this thing, all right? So he wanted to talk. I said, now, Mr. Gary, I can get him over here. But I said, this is a big deal. I said, I'm going to need your help. It was to convince him. He said, what do you want me to do, Mr. Cole? I said, and these are all farm boys, you know, I said, I want you to pat your foot while I play the music. He said, I understand. So we get the Germans over here. Now we're asking them to spend $1 million up front on engineering with no guarantees that they're going to get an order. Now, you can imagine how nervous they are, okay? So now we used to have these meetings. We'd rent a big room at the Marriott ballroom or something.
About what year is this?
I presented my drawing in 80, so it had to be 1980. It had to be 80, okay. So And because they'd come over four, five, or six at a time, you know. So we kind of Texanized them before we took them in to see the customer. But finally, it got down to the point where I said, Mr. Garrett, they're willing to do it, but what they're worried about is that you're going to peddle their drawings. By that, I mean you're going to take their engineering and go and give it to their competitor so they can bid against them, all right? And I said, what I need you to do to make them comfortable, I want you to swear to secrecy on this project, that you won't be talking to anyone else about this, what we're doing, you know? And I said, that and the Germans wanted a small token, like a, if they didn't go forward with this, they would pay them $200,000. Some, they won't spend $1 million, you know? And so we got Mr. Gary and him to agree that, give him that letter. Didn't give him no money, just give him a letter. And the Germans kept working. It took them 2 years. They had to do wind tunnel tests on this boom, you know? They went to TV tower people, make these TV towers, and it's like a TV tower laying down, all right, you know, one of them long towers. It had to withstand hurricane force winds, it had to withstand ice on it, an inch thick, you know, blah, blah. So anyhow, things are rocking on there, and it takes 2 years, and we get this order, you know. In January, I think, of 83, we get this $27 million purchase order from a public utility with no bids. I told the Germans that's the way it would happen, but they said, oh, no. I said, yes, it will, because I said, I know their timetable. They cannot wait another 2 years for someone to engineer their stuff. They got to have this machine. And I say it'll save them $20 million a year. You know, the risk is pretty low. We're going to cut their costs from $1.50 a yard to 50 cents a yard. We're going to save them $1 a yard on 20 million yards a year. We're saving them to, you know, the machine will pay for itself in a year, within 2 years at most, all right? See, so, and that's what happened. The first time our competitors knew about anything that even was going on is when they read about it, the order in the Wall Street Journal. Now, you talk about upset. The Krupp was one big one, K-R-U-P-P. I'm sure you heard of them. And then Ornstein and Koppel, O-N-K. Both of them made big German belts. So if I should get a gold star for anything, it's getting an order from a public utility for an innovative idea with no bids and it full bore price, all right? Which it was worth it. Because, like I said, it paid for itself in two. And that machine went on to run for 20 years. So I'm not trying to take arithmetic, but 20 times 20 million, that's $400 million that we save the ratepayers. Because, you know, the Texas utilities supposedly, they charge the ratepayers according to what it's cost them, all right? So if we can lower their costs, it should lower the ratepayers' price, your electric bill, my electric bill, all right? Later on, after I'm out of the loop, they build a second one, not from DMAG, but they get another German out of Austria, Voestalpine, to build one up here in Mount Pleasant. It runs for 20 years. It saves 20 million.
So where did the first one go?
Fairfield. The second went to Mount Pleasant. But I'm out of the loop. Now, here's what happened. Talk about getting these horses shut off under you. We get the order. You know, everybody, I'm a hero. Morris Bailey's a hero. We're all elated. Now, we're owned by Pioneer Gas. The chairman of the board of Pioneer Gas, who likes his alcohol, gets rolled out because they tell him, you need to go out and take the cure wherever they go to. Take the cure, you know. And if you don't graduate, don't come back. Well, he went out there and stayed 3 days and came back and told him to kiss his, you know what. So he's out. Well, now the guy that took his place, David Culver, he was a teetotaler. Well, Bailey, my boss, he would drink with Tex Watson and socially, and they got along good. Well, that wasn't the case with Dave Culver. So Dave Culver, he started twisting on the chain of my boss, and you know who won. My boss is out now, all right? Who was happy with me? All right, I got 5 years. I've been here, and I didn't knock the ball out of the park. Well, they send two guys in to replace him. And these two guys, both of them lightweight, they saw what I had coming, $500,000 commission. Ain't nobody worth that. Hang on. They want me to sign a new contract that the most I could make on any future sales would be $50,000. I was afraid if I signed that contract, it would weaken my position to collect what I just got on the first one, all right? And I said, you know, when I tried to explain to him, I said, you don't understand. I work on these deals 5 years. You know, you divide this, my time I spend on this thing for over a five-year period, it's not that much money. And I said, furthermore, if you think I'm being greedy, I didn't cut myself in for any of the parts business. This thing is going to eat parts. It runs 24/7. You know, I said, it's going to eat. You're getting all the parts business, which is a high margin business. I get nothing of that. And you're going to get that for the next 30 years, all right? Why are you complaining? See? Because when they called me in to Dallas after my boss got rolled out, I thought they're going to put the arm around me and say, Cole, we like what you've been doing. Just keep on doing it, man. Here's a corner office, big desk, nice window. But that ain't what it was. The opposite.
Let me pause this just for a moment. Okay, we're back now. He's talking about his negotiating skills.
You see, when I got went to work, first time in my life, I was 35 years old. And I listened to these tapes and read these books by Earl Nightingale, who said, if you're not established in your career at 40 years old, you know, you're not going to be there, you know. So I knew I had five years to get established. So as I'm driving around, see, I'm covering a big territory, you know, San Antonio, Rockdale, you know. They got mines down at San Miguel, which, you know, between Corpus Christi and so
this is all strip mining, right?
Yeah. Now that's not Texas Utility down there, somebody else, but still I'm responsible for it. And then I'm calling on Western Coal Power Plants. There's one at LaGrange, one at Houston, at Richmond, there's one at Cason up here, there's one in Amarillo. I'm going into these different branches. We got a branch in San Antonio. We got one in Dallas. We got one in Longview, you know. And I'm interacting with these branch managers. I'm interacting with these salespeople, you know, in their territory. But as I'm traveling, I'm listening to these cassette tapes. The organization I got my tapes from, that whole library full of them was called Earl Nightingale and Conant, or Nightingale and Conant, that was. And I must have bought $5,000 worth of stuff over a period of years. And I'd listen for 20 hours a week driving. So I'm, you know, got a lot of dry windshield time, all right? So I'm listening to these tapes. And I mean, anything you want to listen on, you know. And so I remember one of them was, the sale is not made until a check clears the bank. <You know? laughs> that comes into play here in a minute. I spent 4 months trying to convince these guys not to screw with me, all right? Because I recruited you people. You know, you didn't.
You're talking about the new CEOs?
Yeah, I said, I recruited Plains Machinery. You guys didn't recruit me. I said, I brought you the account. I got the relationship with Texas Utilities. I had the relationship with the Germans. I had the relationship with Melro Multiwheel up here. I said, did I come up with this idea? I said, what are you complaining about? You know, the jealousy, you know, it's you either get run off for one or two reasons. You don't sell nothing or you sell too much. You see what I'm saying? So I finally convinced them after a little push and shove to pay me off, I'd leave. And so, and they hadn't got their money. All they got was 10% when we signed the order. See, it comes in progress payments. You understand how that is. So they had cough up. I was on a draw. I owed them $200,000. So they wrote me a check for $300,000, and I walked out the door. And I didn't want to leave, but I had to. And they didn't sell a dime worth after I left, you know. And the war that replaced me, he couldn't have. So say he couldn't have got laid on, in a woman's prison with a handful of pardons. Because, you know, a good salesman looks like he fell off a turnip truck. Just a good old boy, you know. Johnny Carson, if you ever watch Johnny Carson, you know, he made it look easy. Then some of these guests he'd have was smart off to him, and he'd say, oh, you get on my seat. And they would just wilt, you know what I mean? When I was at my best, when I just, oh, shucks, you know, and the people around you, these bean counters that are paid to follow you around and work with you, they'd actually think you're that dumb. You know, what are they paying this cat for? All he does is eat free meals and kick clouds off his feet. They get to believe in it because they hadn't been to psychologists, these sales courses, and understand, you know, all this stuff about human beings and person, you know, blah, 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 you know what I'm talking about. And so that was part of my problem is this, you know, I just, you know, this PhD, who was a beautiful guy, I mean, a wonderful educated, taught at University of Houston. I take him in to see the customer down here, and PhDs are taught to never admit they don't know. They always got to have an answer, you know? At least they was back then, all right? And he'd be dealing with this mine manager, you know, and invariably he would make the guy feel bad because, you know, he's kind of talking down to him. You see what I'm saying? Suddenly, you know, I mean, I could, but when I went in there and I'm talking to the mine manager, he's feeling good. He said, boy, I'm making him look like an Einstein, all right? And I tried to explain that to the PhD, and it just went right over his head. He was mad. He was upset with me trying to teach him.
Yeah.
I didn't have a college degree. So, yeah, so much for that. But, yeah, I got my check, and I'm really hurt because, you know, I wanted to be part of the team, you know. And I figured I had done my part, and here they did this to me. And so I was pretty down on corporate America. And so I went business myself, which was a mistake.
You did what?
Went in business for myself.
Okay.
I was a manufacturer rep. I don't know what that is, but that's the guy that, like the one I had was out in Canada, Toronto, Montreal. They were the largest wire rope manufacturer in Canada, sold 60% of the market. Now, when I say wire rope, I'm talking about cable that big around for these drag lines, mm-hmm. You know. And the customer would bid the job. It's all right, we're going to buy this much wire rope, turn in your bid. Well, when they opened in mine at Jewett, Texas down there, I got the order to put the wire rope. I sold 5 miles of wire rope, 3-inch wire rope for $500,000. I got 5%, $25,000. My company wasn't 6 months old. I said, man, this is like shooting fish in a barrel. This is going to be good. Now I'm paying my own salary, my own expenses, blah, 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 blah. Well, fast forward 2-3 years, I haven't got another order because I don't know if you remember the 80s. I don't know how old you are, but things started down real bad in the 80s, all right, you know. And the problem with me, I stuck with these guys. They kept saying, oh, we'll be there next time. Well, what I didn't understand, the Canadian market, they're more socialized. They're not quick on their feet. They can't react like we do here. As this market went into a free fall, and the competitors started cutting their prices. They were cutting their prices in Canada, but it wasn't fast enough, all right, to get the bid, all right? And it's leaving me out here to dry, okay? And I'm stupid enough to keep hanging around because I got that first taste. Had I never got that first order, I'd have hooked them a long time ago, all right? That's the problem. It was the worst. It was the best thing happened to me, and the worst thing happened to me, all right?
Blessing and a curse.
That's right. I kept drilling in a dry hole, all right? Rather than moving the rig, you know? And all of a sudden, I looked up here, and I did some other things. I invested in a tax shelter down at Normandy, Texas. It's an embryo transplant deal, you know. I was going to shelter some of this money, you know. I put $50,000 in there in the shelter, and when the smoke cleared, I think that the boy collected $20 million, and somehow or another, they spent it all, and there wasn't nothing left for us. And on top of that, the government come back and disallowed my, you know, they said I owed them $50,000. So I was $100,000 down from where I thought I was, all right? And that was my fallback position, so to speak, you know, when I started losing airspeed and altitude. And so by within 5 years, I went from a hero to a zero, if you can believe it. At A9, Caterpillar lost money for the first time in the history of their company. Our illustrious John Connolly, ex-Treasury of the United States, took personal bankruptcy. They're selling the furniture on his front lawn in San Antonio, all right? Eddie Childs, a Western company. I'm mad too, Eddie. I don't remember him or not. He took bankruptcy, all right? So I was in good company. All right? I didn't take bankruptcy. I just hunkered down and lost my house, car. And had plus, by that time, the good jobs were gone. I mean, DMAG got absorbed by Komatsu. Corin got absorbed by Terex. I mean, there was a bloodbath, just you know, upside down. And so I went to work for half at what I was working previously, you know, and I had to get out of the machinery business. I was selling articulate concrete blocks, erosion control stuff, you know. I did that. I got that job because of my contacts with the customer, you know, because Texas Utilities does a lot of reclamation, you know. But anyhow, that DMAG deal was, that was a home run. That was, I said, that's my Super Bowl ring, you know. Yeah. You know, you don't, that's unheard of to play the role that I played in that, you know, from, it's just unheard of. And then the fact that they did that, what they did to me, you know.
Yeah.
And So
the strip mining, they're not doing that anymore, right? Is that true?
No, that's right. What happened was let's go back to the beginning, okay? At Malakoff, Texas in the 20s, they were mining, whether it's Texas Electric Service or Texas Power and Light or that, I don't know who it was, but it's in this little book here, was mining, strip mining at Malakoff and burning it, hauling it to Trinidad Power Plant in Trinidad, Texas. Okay? And they did that in the 20s, and then the 30s, I think the gas come along, and they got out of they got out of that business and went to burning gas, all right? Well, in the 40s and 50s, I think, or 34, and it tells you that in this book here, History of Texas Utilities, somebody at Texas Utilities decided that maybe we need to go ahead and tie up some of these reserves, you know, at this real cheap price, because no one thought it was worth anything. So they went to drilling over 10, 20-year period, drilling all over Texas, you know, finding out where the seams were, where the good stuff was. And they tied it up. Well, sure enough, come along the 60s. Well, then they started, that's when they down at Rockdale, they decided, well, let's see if we can sell some of this stuff. Let's get an aluminum company in here. And they talked to Alcoa into coming in, and they made a co-op deal with them, all right? So that's how they cut their teeth on a big time, big drag lines, and you know, and so. But by the 60s, things were looking. They could see natural gas was, the price was rising. So they opened the plant, I think, at Fairfield in 71. That was 575 megawatt units. And then mid-70s, they opened this unit at Mount Pleasant called Monticello. By the way, at Fairfield, it's called Big Brown. And then up here at Henderson, Tatum, you know, Beckville area, it's called Morton Lake. That was the biggie. That was the three 750-megawatt units. And but as I mentioned to you the other day, at Big Brown in 1975, they told me that Cliff Irwin said, why it's so critical for you to meet our service needs on a 24-hour basis is that if we go down because your equipment, you can't service it, and we have to switch to natural gas, which we can do, in lieu of coal. At Fairfield, to give you an example, those two units, 1,150 units, megawatts total, I believe, will cost us $500,000 difference that we'll have to pay Lone Star Gas or whoever it is they buy gas from between what we can mine the lignite for. That's the differential. So that can get in your pocket. So they're not going to be very understanding of me if my machine breaks down and I don't have the fan belt to fix it, all right? Well, I not only got to have the parts, I got to have service, I got to be, you know, prepared. That's why Caterpillar was doing so good. Caterpillar had good equipment and they had good service and a lot of it. A lot of parts, you know, and so you had to get to be able to play on that basis in order to hold Texas Utilities' attention, and so, oh lordy, but get back to, so there was in Malakoff, all right, they got Fairfield running, and then they got Mount Pleasant running, and then they got the big one here. And they ran, and those were in the 70s. I got involved, like I say, in the 70s. And they ran up until 4 or 5 years ago. They shut Rockdale down, Fairfield down, imploded the power plant.
Would that be what was Luminant?
Huh?
Would that be what was Luminant?
Yeah, Well, let me tell you that. You just brought up a good question. And this is in this book. You'd be interested in this. Okay, KKR and TBJ, that's Kravis, whatever, Roberts out of New York, and Texas Pacific Gas out of Fort Worth, I think. Big money people. You may be aware of this. They bought out TXU in 2007 for $45 billion. Now, that's fine. It was worth that, but here's what happened to them. This is about the time, see, this big deal in New York, they got all the reserves, they got the power plants, you know, the nuclear and everything, I believe. Because at that time, gas was high. Well, lo and behold, George Mitchell out of the Woodlands, you're aware of that story, right? They figured out how to frack this rock and get the gas out of it. Well, all of a sudden, gas prices, we got an abundance of gas, all right?
Well, through fracking.
Fracking.
Yeah.
Fracking. You talk about the timing, poor timing. This fracking came on board. All of a sudden, they can buy, this gas is cheap. They can buy gas much cheaper than they can mine the lignite. So this whole thing goes belly up. Goes bank. This, here it is right here. It says right here. The largest LBO bust in history. This was written in 2003. That other one was written. This was written, I think, 23, September 23, 2020. I think that's when it's written. But anyhow, they're explaining what happened here. But it was the largest leverage buyout in history. It went belly up. I heard that, whether it's true or not. I heard that Warren Buffett lost $1 billion in it. Which to him, that's no big deal, but he's a smart guy. There were some smart people in this deal, but,
Was going from lignite to gas?
Well, they were going to use the lignite, and that's how they're going to make they get their money back, all right? They had all these reserves, because gas was high, and therefore they could, all of a sudden, gas got cheap. and they could use gas instead of lignite, cheaper. Not counting all the other problems associated with environmental cleanup, blah, 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 blah. But the cost of energy. But I'm just telling you, here's some very astute investors that got burnt real bad. So a lot of times you can be the smartest guy in the class, you know, and the most experienced, and you still go zigging when you should have been zagging, or, you know, so.
Get your horse shot out from under you.
What's that?
Or as you said earlier, get your horse shot out.
Right, at a full gallop. So anyhow, they started shutting these mines down here about 5 years ago, imploding them, power plants, chopping up the drag lines, you know, selling it for scrap, whatever they do, sell parts or whatever. The only power plant that's still running is the one at Martin Lake. Now, the mine is closed. I think I told you today, they're importing coal from Gillette, Wyoming. It's a little higher grade. It's bituminous. It don't take as much.
Yeah.
You know, it probably takes a train 3 miles long rather than 4 miles, all right? Or the lignite would take a train 4 miles every day to keep those.
How much earth was moved when they were doing all that lignite?
Best as I can tell, it's around 400 million yards a year.
400 million cubic yards.
That's the earth that was moved, dig it down, the coal that was hauled to the power plant, and then 10% of the stuff got to be put back, recovery, all right? When you add all those three material handling quantities together, you come up with about 400 million yards, as close as I can figure, okay? 408, which is about, I think the Panama Canal was 211 million yards, cubic yards of dirt to dig it. So they basically were digging the Panama Canal twice a year, and no one even knew about it, all right? You know, you got people right here at Lufkin that not aware
that
it was going on, all right? You know, and now what makes it so unique? All these, say I'm 85, and when I was out there, most of these guys were my age or a little older than me. So most of them are older than me right now and either dying or retirement homes. And a lot of them are not computer literate. They're not on Facebook. They're not on, you know, yada, yada. And so I got all these pictures, you know, and I'm one of the very few that has a range of pictures that I have, or, you know, in a, say, 10-year period from 75 to 85, 86, 11-year window there, which was the real hot window that they were doing things. And I'm sitting here saying, my God, this is one of the biggest earth-moving projects in the history of the world. Went on in our state. It's part of Texas history. And if I don't share these pictures and help tell the story, this thing could, you know, just wither away. Because they're not sharing it with their kids. Because they don't have any pictures to share with their kids, all right? And they're getting so old now, they can't remember. You know. I'm lucky that at 85, I can remember a lot of this stuff, all right? See, so that's why my goal now is to share this stuff, because I realize what's happening. You know, I realize the magnitude. This is, and part of that is because same thing happened in my books. When this rice farmer disappeared, you know, I didn't know if I told you the story about the book, but I had these slides, and I was introduced to a magazine out of Iowa called Two Cylinder, and it's supported by John Deere. And it's an antique tractor magazine. And I got to subscribe into it, and so I decided, well, let me just send my slides and see what this, because, you know, I was proud of them, but it's like being proud of the kids. I didn't know what they would think of them. So in 2003, I just shipped them to Iowa, to this. I didn't hear anything back. And I said, well, maybe they didn't like them. Well, one day I go to my post, to the mailbox, and get my magazine. It comes out 6 times a year. And there was a 10-page article in this magazine on my book. I like to fell over. I immediately called them and was just thanking them, you know, gratuitously. And they were as elated as I was. They said, Cole, we've never run a 10-page article on anybody in history of this magazine at 20 years old. And the reason we ran one on you is because we never got any pictures like this in 20 years. Farmers don't take pictures in the field. And see, but because I was in my 20s, full of vim and vigor, I was in charge, I had the checkbook, remember I told you? I took all these pictures, see? And the fact that I moved 13 times, it's a wonder they weren't lost. Fire, flood, tornado. So anyhow, 10 years later, I sent them another batch, different batch, and they do the same thing. Well, then I'm 70-some years old, and I'm saying to my... Well, in the meantime, they had put out a plea nationwide to all their subscribers for them to send in pictures like I did. Well, nothing happened. Well, then that's what told me there was no pictures out there. Farmers weren't carrying cameras in the field. You see what I'm saying? I realized then it was on me to share what I had, or it was going to be lost, you know. And that's when I decided to put the book together. I didn't start out to write that book. I backed into that book, all right? And then that kind of led me to backing into this, all right? The same mentality,
right.
See? So what I'm doing now is trying to get people like you to document this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, take what I got and put it into some form that can be passed on to future generations. Because someday this is going to be a big deal, you know? Once they realize, when people get their arms running.
Well, I think that's probably good for at least the first interview.
Yeah. Well, like I said,
we covered a lot of ground, but
right.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the slides themselves and things like
that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I guess I will stop the recorder. And thank you. Okay. We went right at 2 hours. So I will stop it.